Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
You're listening to Luke's English Podcast. For more information, visit teacherluke.co.uk. Hello, listeners, and hello, video viewers. Welcome to another episode of Luke's English Podcast. Let me just tell you what you can expect from this episode today. So this is a swap cast between Luke's English Podcast and English with Ray, which means that we are both uploading this to our podcasts and YouTube channels. Okay, so you can find this on my channel and also Ray's channel. Ray Adam, is an English teacher from Glasgow in Scotland, and you'll be able to notice his accent, which is not the strongest Glaswegian accent I've ever heard, but it's definitely noticeable, which is great because I love Scottish accents. So Ray is from Scotland, and he has recently started making videos on YouTube for learners of English. So he's an online English teacher who has recently started making YouTube videos. And one of Ray's students, whose name is Ivan, and I think Ivan is from Russia, probably. So Ivan suggested to Ray that he start doing videos on YouTube, and that he also contact me for an interview, because Ivan is a Lepster, and he said, hey, you should start doing podcast episodes, and you should invite Luke Thompson onto your show. So that's what you're going to listen to or watch here. Okay, this is Ray Adam interviewing me for his channel. And this is a fairly relaxed and free-ranging conversation. And after chatting a bit about playing music and performing music and comedy in front of audiences of people, we ended up talking about the psychology of learning English, particularly how to manage anxiety or nerves when using English in stressful situations like presentations or job interviews and things like that. And we also give our comments on how to work on your confidence and how to have the right mental approach to learning a language, which is one of the most important steps to take. Before you start anything, really, you've got to kind of get the right attitude about your learning. So listen on for some comments and tips about how to manage your stress levels in English, how to become more confident in English, and how to take control of your communication skills in general. And as well as that, if you've ever seen my YouTube videos and you've noticed that there are guitars on the walls and things, and you've wondered about them, we talk a little bit, maybe for the first 5 minutes, about one of the guitars on my walls. So there's a bit of guitar chat before we get into the language learning stuff. Thank you to Ray for sending this recording to me. This was originally supposed to be just on his channel, but this might be a good way to sort of bring exposure to him. You might want to check out Ray's channel on YouTube. It's called English with Ray. You'll find a link in the description. And Ray only has a few videos there at the moment, but everyone's got to start somewhere. I've noticed that Ray also speaks fluent Arabic, so any Arabic-speaking Lepsters might be particularly interested in Ray's content, as he might have some insights into differences between Arabic and English. I'm not sure he's actually specifically covered that yet, you know, Arabic and English, or some sort of video or content for Arabic speakers learning English. I don't know if he's done any of that content yet. But maybe that's something he could work on in the future, in a future video. But anyway, Arabic speakers, you might be particularly interested in finding out about Ray Adam. Okay, anyway, that's it for this introduction. And I will now let you listen to this conversation between me and Ray. Firstly, about playing music, and then about the challenges of managing your confidence when using English in stressful situations. I'll probably speak to you again briefly at the end of this chat, maybe just on the audio version, I'll probably come back and ramble to you a little bit and maybe even play a song on the guitar or something like that. That might just be in the audio version. But in any case, it's now time for me to just let you listen to this conversation. Okay, so here we go. Let's get started right now.
Oh, we're rolling. Thank you so much for coming on and joining me today.
It's a pleasure, Ray. Thank you very much for inviting me. It's always nice to be invited onto things. There are more and more sort of teachers doing podcasts and YouTube channels and stuff, English teachers. And every now and then I get a little invite from someone.
Yeah, I think it's a kind of cool way that the teaching method is developing, is that you now have things like this. You had the YouTube videos, now we have discussions like such.
That's right. I mean, the internet's incredible, the way it has brought English to learners of English in this way. Mm-hmm. There was a time when it was very, very hard to find the right kind of audio material or video material for learning English. And it was really, really difficult for learners to do it. And they would get sort of like tapes or even vinyl records of English being spoken, or like finding, you know, tuning into the BBC World Service and stuff like that. Whereas these days with the internet, you just go onto YouTube or wherever and bang, there it is. There's people speaking directly to you.
I guess with learning anything, if you want to learn an instrument and I see you have some instruments behind you, or learning a language, learning anything. Yeah. I'm guessing you're in a band, or you are in a band. Is that a Stratocaster?
So on this left. side, on the left behind me, there is a Fender Stratocaster. That's right. I can show you if you like.
Yeah, please.
All right. Hold on. All right. Bear with me while I put the headphones back in.
It looks American. It's an American Strat, right?
It's not. It's a Mexican made.
Paintwork on the body looks beautiful.
Isn't it? It's actually a natural finish, so there's no paintwork. Can you see the grain of the wood in it?
Yeah, yeah. What's that part called? I forget the name. On the other side. Is it called the scratch board or something?
Scratch plate.
Scratch plate looks lovely.
So this is actually a Mexican-made Fender Stratocaster. Oh, can you hear me?
Yeah, I hear you. I hear you.
You can hear me all right, can you? It's a Mexican-made Fender Stratocaster. It's the Player series, right? So they have these different series made in different places. The Player series is generally the cheapest of the Fender range, and it does say Fender on the headstock, you know?
Yeah.
It's the cheaper of the range, but this is nice. This was a limited edition in this kind of natural finish with the tortoise shell scratch plate and these kind of cream or off-white pickups. And I guess it's a rosewood fingerboard. But yeah, it's beautiful, isn't it? I wish I could justice. Sure. You can't really hear it. But
That chord you're doing, I think it's called an E7♭9 or something. That's the one Jimi Hendrix used to always play, right?
Jimi Hendrix, yeah. For me, Jimi Hendrix like chord is like this. That's the Jimi Hendrix chord. And this one, that's the James Brown.
Ah, okay. Okay, cool.
You know.
Sweet.
Anyway, that's a Fender Strat. And the other one.
That's a bass, right?
That's a bass, yeah.
Sure.
Yeah, that's actually the one I play more than this, because I'm not so good on the guitar. I'm more of a bass player. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so are you into guitars and stuff too? Do you play?
No. I used to a lifetime ago, in fact. But I used to have a Japanese Stratocaster, and, you know, I loved Jimi Hendrix growing up.
Yes. A Japanese Strat, that's nice. That beats a Mexican one, I think.
It was okay. It was kind of falling apart. So, well, to be honest, I had a Mexican Stratocaster body, but the Japanese Stratocaster neck was like a maple neck, and I swapped the bodies, and the pickups from the Japanese one went into the Mexican body. But the bridge pickup was broken, so I got like a humbucker pickup, and it was kind of like a Frankenstein guitar. But it was cool. I liked it.
Sounds good. Yeah. I like those kinds of guitars, especially when you put a humbucker pickup on a Strat. That's always interesting.
Yeah, sure. It sure is. So did you start, what came first for you? Was it music or was it teaching?
Oh, music, definitely. Mm-hmm. I first started playing the piano when I was 11. So I decided, it like a lot of kids, like they take piano lessons because their parents tell them to.
Sure.
And I was actually kind of the rare exception where I got to 11 and I was like, I want to play the piano. I think it's because we had a neighbor who was older than us, and he played piano really, really well. And he did all that boogie woogie stuff, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So he would play all this amazing boogie woogie piano. And I would just stand there, you know, my jaw on the floor. and I decided I wanted to learn piano too. So I ended up taking lessons with the same teacher. And so for 5 years I studied classical piano. And,
Have you done a lot of concerts? Have you played on stage many times?
Not piano, no. Because when I you know, I hit 15, 16 and decided that I would be much more interested in other things in life, suddenly I got distracted by everything else, like the girls and like, you know, stuff like that. And I decided classical music wasn't really my cup of tea. So anyway, I then ended up playing the drums. Mm-hmm. So we were lucky to have a kind of garage that wasn't connected to the house, and we had a drum kit in it. So I would go and play the drums every day for an hour. I was supposed to play the piano for an hour to practice, mm-hmm. but I would just end up going and playing the drums. Mm-hmm. And I was a huge fan of Jimi Hendrix too. So Mitch Mitchell was like my favorite drummer, and I tried to copy all the things Amazing. He did. I didn't play concerts on piano, but I've done quite a lot of gigs and things on drums mostly, and some bass.
Tell me about your first ever gig. You know, so I think this is an interesting topic for us to talk about, because back when I was playing guitar, as I said, a lifetime ago, I was like inside my bedroom. I was rocking. You know, I had the long hair and I was really getting into it. But then you go in front of a stage and it's very different. Everyone's staring at you and, you know, the nerves kick in and, for me, I had a bad experience the first, I think I did like 5 or 6 gigs, but the first time I went on stage, I had a bad experience because my nerves mm-hmm. got the better of me. But why I think right. that might be of benefit to some of our students that could be listening to this is they might be able to speak in English to a degree, like privately, or they're mm-hmm. watching something they understand, or they're talking to their teacher and it's cool. But the second they go to a job interview, or they go in a different country, or there's a few people listening, or they're talking to different people, again, it's the nerves. We have this expression that unregulated emotion is the enemy of performance. And I found that to be the case in music. I found when my nerves kicked in, I couldn't perform as well. But yeah, have you had any really nervous experiences going up on stage?
Yeah, lots and lots. Mm-hmm. Loads. Not so much in music, though. As a drummer, I always felt like sitting by the drum kit was where I wanted to be, mm-hmm. and it was just exciting. And sure. the advantage of being the drummer is that you're not the one on the front. At the front, you don't have to remember lyrics or talk to the audience. Uh-huh. You're just there to, you know, provide the groove or whatever. So, no, not so much as a drummer, but I've definitely felt a lot of nerves in other things. So I do comedy as well. I do stand up.
That's right. I saw that on your website.
Yeah. And so that is much, much more nerve wracking.
I can imagine.
And I've definitely had that feeling many times of, you know, you're going to go up on stage in half an hour or something. And I'm just, can't get comfortable, trying to get comfortable. You've got butterflies in your stomach.
Sure.
Your neck and your back go all stiff, you know, like this. You don't breathe properly. And it's a horrible feeling, absolutely awful.
And how do you regulate it? How do you mitigate that stress?
So three things. First thing is preparation, right? So prepare for the thing that you're going to do. And that means, you know, you've got to prepare in the right way too. So for me doing stand-up, it's about remembering the material or the main points I want to make, and then just performing it again and again, hopefully in front of an audience, right? But if not, on my own, just doing it again and again, so the words all come out, or I remember all the things I've got to say. So preparation. Second thing is like just physically, like what you do, how you breathe and how you hold yourself physically before the thing happens, in order to manage those horrible debilitating nervous feelings that you get in your body. So I find that sort of like either moving around, getting up, moving around a bit, or remembering to take deep breaths, you know, to try and get things under control, because when you're nervous, you start to breathe kind of shallow, in a shallow way from up here like this. So you've got to make sure that get the oxygen all the way in. So remember to take, you know, deep breaths to kind of get things under control. And I also found that doing things like opening up my body and stretching would actually really help to gain a bit more control over myself. The tendency is when you're feeling nervous is to kind of go into a ball. You see comedians, and I've done it myself, sitting there kind of in a little ball with their paper and their notes on it, and they're all wrapped up like this. And even on stage or when you're performing or anything, the tendency is to protect, you know, to kind of start to get that kind of protective body language. We've seen it many times, people standing in front of people, and for some reason, one leg crosses over in front of the other one.
Arms crossing as well.
I mean, as a teacher, I've seen many presentations from students, and you get odd things like people just talking to one side of the room. And this side of the room has not been, you know, you're kind of, your shoulder is cutting them off. You know, it's all about trying to control your body, standing open, shoulders back a little bit, and doing that basically tells your body, it's like, I am, when you're nervous, you, as I said, you want to go defensive. If you force yourself to open out, it kind of tells your body not to be nervous in a weird way. It can help a bit.
Yeah, sure. I mean, you made a lot of really good points about, like, the breathing becomes really shallow and the body responds. And see, when we feel any emotion, whether it's anger or sadness or nervousness, there is some kind of response in the body. The body starts doing something. You know, you go from nervous thought to feeling to reaction. But if you stay in this kind of crunched over, you know, way, then it's kind of enabling that pattern of just negative feelings. And although it's difficult to control the mind, you can control the body. You can open it back up. You can breathe deeply, and you can try and slow down your thinking, and then come back to a more rational response rather than being emotional and flustered.
And take those regular deep.
People underestimate how important that is. Like, you know, when you're breathing shallower, I think it actually causes this hormone to be released called cortisol, which is like the stress hormone, which is going to make you feel more stressed. And, you know, all of that oxygen quickly going into your brain for that, like, fight or flight response, you know, we need to just calm down, because when you get like that, that's the way of breathing to, when, if you're in a fight or someone's chasing you. But it's not a way to be if you're, for example, giving a presentation. It's not a way to be if you're perhaps trying to do stand-up comedy. You don't want to be panicked. You're not going to be, you're going to miss a lot of cues from the audience or make mistakes in your planning if you're in that kind of flustered state.
Yeah, absolutely. I said three, right? So I've got to finish my list. In fact,
please go ahead.
The third thing is experience, right? Basically, which is that the more you do it, the more times you go through the experience, the more you're able to manage it, and the more you get used to it. You never get rid of the nerves completely, but you learn how to manage them. So experience is the thing. If it's job interviews, you know, you've got to do lots of job interviews. You've got to practice. If it's a presentation, you know, try doing it in front of different audiences and stuff like that. The experience makes a huge difference. And the fourth thing, which I've just added one, is to try to remember that you're, as well as doing a job or trying to get a job or whatever it is, you've got to try and remember also you're here to enjoy the experience. You're here to try and enjoy your life and express yourself. And when you can, when you can put a bit of joy into it and a bit of personality into it, suddenly that brings it to another level where it's not so much an ordeal that you're trying to get through, but rather it suddenly becomes actually something that you're going to enjoy and that you can enjoy expressing yourself. And that's surely the best way to turn it around. Because often with these situations, we feel like we are being attacked by an experience and we've just got to get through it. But the best way to do it is to attack the experience itself.
Yeah, I completely agree. Completely agree with that. For example, like if you're going to a job interview, there's all these thoughts of they're not going to give me the job, then I'm not going to have the money, then I can't get the girl, then I can't live the lifestyle, I can't buy the thing that I want. And if I don't get it, people know I was applying for the job and they'll think it's because of my bad English or my lack of skills. And, you know, the mind starts kind of running crazy. But see, when you're there, if you just remind yourself why you're there, and furthermore, like, you want to build rapport with the person who's talking to you. You want to kind of make, like, leave them with a kind of nice feeling about you, go and have a pleasant conversation. And if you're just in there and you're enjoying that conversation and you're kind of creating a nice relationship with someone, it just creates a nicer impression, a nicer vibe. You feel better and you don't really leave thinking I made all of these mistakes because of my nerves.
I mean, I've observed so many people as an English teacher, you know, I've been doing that for a long time and I've done all of the stuff like job interview situations and all manner of different things, presentation tasks and stuff. And there are some people who essentially wait for things to come to them or something. They don't really grab the situation by the scruff of the neck. You know, they kind of just sort of wait like for a job interview. It's just kind of like imparting the information, but there's no real sense that the person is keen to connect with you in some way. You know, you've got to push it further and really sort of in a job interview, I always recommend that people sort of sit up and sit forward because it shows, look, I'm really keen and I'm interested and I'm listening and I'm ready to give my answers. You've got to try to put yourself into it and try to enjoy it as well. There's got to be some fun in sharing ideas and communicating. You've got to try and enjoy the whole thing.
Oh, completely. Yeah. Plus with, you know, you and I as English language teachers, you know, we teach words and we teach grammar. That's probably what we spend a lot of our days working on. But when it comes to communication, it's so much more of a broad subject. In fact, words are only 7% of communication. And that's probably where you and me work. We work in that 7% of communication, words. But as you said, body language is a very big part. They say body language actually accounts for 70% of communication. Mm-hmm. And if you're not feeling good, it manifests itself in your in the body language. And I think it's really apparent to, like, if you're on the stage and you don't feel confident and you allow those unconfident feelings to take charge of your body, it's going to be very clear to the audience that you're not feeling confident, or to the interviewer that you're not feeling confident, or to the person you are, let's say, meeting or on a date with. It's going to be very clear that you're not confident if you're allowing those things to control your manners.
Yeah, it's like when you feel nervous, it causes your body to sort of behave nervously.
Yeah.
So in order to try and, you can try and reverse, it's like reversing the polarities or something. You kind of control your body, force yourself to sit up and sit
and look
more
confident. Sure.
Yeah. And that then somehow causes you mentally to feel a bit better. It can remove some of the anxiety when you take a non-anxious body posture. Mm-hmm. It's sort of like your body releases something which tells you, like, oh, I'm feeling confident and I feel okay and I'm breathing and look, you know, I'm up for it, I'm ready. And that then feeds back into the mental state as well.
Of course. Plus, no one will know that you're not confident. Like, if you're upright with your chest out, your shoulders back and your chin up, and you're still and you're breathing slowly, people will not be able to tell. And I give this example to my students sometimes that, you know, because another part of communication is your tonality. And for example, if you were to ask me a simple math question, like if you asked me, what's 2 + 2? And I said, 4? 4? It's that increase of tonality makes it sound like I'm not sure, even though it's the correct answer. Whereas if you said, what's 2 + 2? And I said, 16. You know, just the decrease in tonality made me sound more confident, even though I was incorrect.
Yeah. And again, I think body language kind of comes into this too, because I find like nodding a little bit when speaking helps to hammer home the thing that you're saying, you know. And also the other thing is eyebrows. And so often when I'm doing pronunciation drills with my students, they probably think I'm crazy, but I'm not. What I do is, as well as trying to get them to repeat lines, you know, of English, I try to get them to do different body language in it too. So it's all about attitude. And a lot of the time I find that raising my eyebrows when I'm doing a pronunciation drill really helps, especially if it's like, you know, a polite question, like, you know, could, do you have the time by any chance? Mm-hmm. You know, yeah, we could do that. I can't think of a good example at this moment, but there are some moments where it's eyebrows down, mm-hmm. and then others when it's eyebrows up. Okay. And like this, there's intonation in your voice, but there's intonation in your body language, sure. as well. So I think going down, it's sort of it's like nodding your head to, you know, emphasize the points you're making, and go, you know, when then there's a more open tone, mm-hmm. Which is a bit more like this. And, you know, it also, it's about opening out your face as well. Mm-hmm. It's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. I love how this has kind of went on to psychology as well, the psychology of communication. It's really fascinating.
Yeah, well, it always ends up being that because, you know, uh-huh. you can teach your students words and you can teach your students words and grammar that they then are expected to just sort of put together in order to send out a sort of verbal email kind of thing sure. in what you're saying. But there's so much more to it than that. It's all about attitude because, you know, body language, as you said, you know, we talk about body language and the importance of it. I would say that what's more important is attitude, and your mental attitude to a situation will inform your body language. You know, it's kind of like both.
Absolutely.
Yeah. When you're really keen, really interested in what the person is saying, then you will end up leaning forwards. Your face will become more open, and you'll be doing, if people are watching the video, probably see my face now, this kind of eyebrows up, nodding my head, listening, right? That is, and that's very important. I think it's really important for communication. Listening is
absolutely
massive. It makes a huge difference to the person you're talking to if they feel that you are listening to them. You know, it helps communication massively. Have you ever spoken to, and as an English teacher, you probably have, have you ever spoken to people who you don't feel are really properly listening? They're not really paying attention.
Yes. I think as a teacher, you get really good at that, especially when you can feel their brains kind of turning off, or sometimes the student's too polite, but you can tell from their facial expression or their lack of eye contact that they just don't understand it or it's going over their head. I think as a teacher, you have to become very empathetic like that.
Yes. Yeah, it's... You know, conversation is a two-way street. And when the other person, when you feel that the other person isn't really listening to you for whatever reason, in this case, it's because they didn't understand, but it could be any other reason. Like, for example, if they're on their phone or something, it's horrible trying to speak to people who aren't really listening to you. And so if you think about that in a communication, in a conversation, a good way to create a good conversation is to show the person you're talking to that you are listening to them. Mm-hmm. You know, you've got to make a big effort. Again, I've seen in classrooms where I set up conversations, three people in each group. And sometimes you see people who are just sort of sitting there like this and having a conversation like the other people over here, having this kind of conversation, like sitting back here. And I kind of think you can't do that. You've got to try and engage with the people you're talking to. And I think this thing is because they, in their minds, like I'm in an English classroom and I am constructing English, and English is what will do the work for me. Mm-hmm. And it's all about constructing the perfect sentence with the perfect grammar, with the right pronunciation, but I'll deliver it from here. Whereas a huge part of it is to actually come in, engage with the people you're talking to. Mm-hmm. So I guess the point I'm making here, I don't know how we got to this, is that, communication and learning English, it's not just about learning words and grammar and even pronunciation. It's about learning the right attitude and adopting the right approach in order to deliver the language in the right way.
Yeah. A lot of students, they come and, you know, like I do one-on-one tutoring, and, you know, they send that first message and the follow-up question is, okay, why do you want to learn English, or what areas are you struggling with? Words to that effect. And a really, really common one is confidence. I'm not feeling so confident. And when you get talking to them, you know, because a lot of that first lesson for me is just learning information about them, you know. So why are you not confident? And what do you think would help you feel more confident? What are your kind of, what do you believe just now are the, I suppose, obstacles in the way to you being more confident? And then they might say it's this or it's that, or they don't know phrasal verbs, or people use phrasal verbs and they don't get phrasal verbs and they aren't feeling confident. But a lot of people, they think that the key to confidence, or maybe you've seen this yourself, like they think the key to fluency is maybe something that they can read or they can learn or they can just revise and then that's it. But it's not quite like that. You know, for fluency, for example, a lot of it is just you need to speak a lot. You need to really regularly speak to get fluent. You can't really learn something that will make you fluent. It's like the speed of which your brain can construct the sentence and your tongue can articulate it. And that's all muscles. Like it has to be exercised. Or with confidence, like you kind of need to have a confident mindset. You kind of need to believe in yourself. And you need to have this desire to have conversations. And when students think that the problem with their confidence is maybe lying in some words or something like that, I think a lot of students are looking in the wrong place for their confidence. Do you have any experience with that?
Well, yeah. It's like one of the most, as you said, it's one of the most common things that people say. And yeah, confidence is a very mysterious one. What is it? Where does it come from? How do you get it? And yeah, a lot of people are not confident because they are very aware of their shortcomings in English. And this obviously makes them unconfident. I know how it feels as a person who struggles to speak French. You know, it does ruin your confidence and you end up sort of, you know, I think I'll just not speak, you know, that's kind of what you do. Yeah, it's a really tricky one. It really is. But the only way to do it is to just try and try again. Just keep on, get back on the horse. You know that expression?
Sure. Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, I guess it comes from gymnastics or something, right? Or horse riding. Anyway, you're trying to do something and you fall off. And you fail, you hit the floor. So, you know, you just got to get back up and get back on the horse and carry on. And, you know, you only develop confidence through failure, right? Right. You know, no one just goes, yay, I'm a huge success from the very beginning. Ta-da, here we go. Most people will fail and try again and sort of like, I don't know, just don't care. You shouldn't really care that much. Mm-hmm. What's the worst thing that's going to happen? If you say some things wrong, people won't understand you. It's not the end of the world. You kind of got to get over it and you've got to just throw yourself in at the deep end and do it regularly. So yes, regular speaking practice is vital. Like, you know, if you want to become good at tennis, you know, what do? You can't just like watch people play tennis forever and read books about playing tennis and watch YouTube videos of people showing you how to play tennis and stuff. You've just got to get out there with a tennis racket in your hand and just do it again and again and again.
Of course.
English is mysterious because it's not like tennis. English is weird. It's like if you could imagine. No, that's a very strange analogy. The thing about English is that you can learn about English in English. Mm-hmm. You can't do the same thing with tennis. But my point is that to get good at it, you've got to try and do it do it on a regular basis.
Absolutely.
Have fun.
Something I might just add to that for anyone who's listening is that a negative thought, so I call them ants, can't remember who said this to me, automatic negative thoughts. An ant that many people have is that I'm just not confident. They think that it's like you just have it or you don't have it. And as you said, it's very mysterious. Where does it come from? How do you get it? But you can learn confident habits. As we have spoken about, like there's the confident body language. There's the confident tone of the voice. There is the confident, you know, eye contact. You can learn these cues. You can learn the confident way of communicating. You know, you act confident. People say, oh, this guy's confident. You know, the treat you as if you're a confident person. It kind of encourages your confidence. And it's like a cycle. Now you're in a confidence cycle, but it comes through practicing that confidence. So yeah, because I hear a lot of people say, I'm just not confident. But that's like saying, I just can't play the guitar. Well, you've never picked up a guitar or opened a guitar book and actually strummed a guitar. So it's something that it can absolutely be learned.
The thing about the guitar is a good one because... Like learning the guitar is really hard. It's really, really hard. You've got to keep practicing it again and again and again. And I just feel like the people who do it are the ones who just really enjoy practicing and really just want to spend time with the guitar in their hands.
Yeah.
And it's just for the joy, just the love of playing. that getting good is not just like a thing I've got to get through. I've got to get good and then I'll be good and then I won't have to worry or stress anymore. Instead, playing the guitar, it's more just like just enjoying it. And as you struggle to sort of enjoy it more and express yourself more, you naturally sort of progress at it. So, just it's all about the journey rather than the destination, isn't it?
Yeah, of course. I would agree. I would completely agree with that. Another point is some students, they haven't really thought about the end. They think that this might be something that they could use. Or like, for example, let's say with playing the guitar, right? Let's say your end goal was just to impress some girls. You know, it's not a deep goal and it's probably not going to be enough to get you to become an immaculate guitar player. But let's say with like doing the IELTS or something, you know that if you do the IELTS, you can go live in this other country. This other country, you're going to be more prosperous and you can have the life that you want. You know, it's a stronger motivation. So I think enjoying the journey and having a strong kind of motivation, I think a combination of the two can be quite beneficial. Yeah.
A strong motivation, definitely. But I would say the thing about the IELTS is, this is going to sound weird as well, that, yeah, you've got to have that motivation. Like, I've got to get the IELTS in order to get X, Y, and Z, these other good things I want. But also, don't forget to focus on sort of enjoying IELTS. I know that's crazy because it's IELTS. Who enjoys it? I don't know. But do you know what I mean? That the task at hand is the improving your English. And so improving your English has to be the thing that you're enjoying. You've got to enjoy the process of doing that. You've got to enjoy just spending time with English, just learning to pronounce the sounds of English and just picking up new words. And just that time that you spend with English has to be satisfying and enjoyable for you in itself, because otherwise you're not going to do it. Like, potentially what might happen is you think, right, I need IELTS in order to get these girls to be impressed with me. And
hey, ladies, I've got 7.5 in IELTS.
So this person is like, right, I need IELTS because of, you know, I need to make my parents happy. I need to get a good job and stuff. But the fact is they don't want to do IELTS. They don't like doing IELTS. IELTS is not nice. And so they don't do it. And then they feel really bad because they feel like I'm not getting that thing and it's all my fault and I feel really bad. Sure. So I would say, yes, focus on your goals, but also enjoy the task at hand. And it will make a huge difference.
Yeah. And see, that goes so much further, not just for English, but just as a life philosophy. Like, I kind of have this idea that we should be trying to be the best version of ourselves. Because see, if you don't have that philosophy and, you know, you wake up early, it's brutal. You know, you try eating a salad, it tastes terrible. You know, you go to the gym, man, I could be watching TV. You know, you're always thinking of, you're not enjoying these individual tasks. But see, if you're waking up early and, you know, you're exercising, you're eating healthy, you're studying, you're learning, learning isn't always necessarily fun. Like, learning communication, it's useful. It's not, a lot of the time, it's not really fun, or learning a language. Some of the parts of it are going to be a bit tedious. It's not always going to be fun. But see, if you know that every time you go to the gym, or every time you wake up early, or every time you learn something, it's like another wee piece of Lego that you're just adding to this tower that you're building. And, you know, you feel like the tower is just getting bigger and bigger. You feel like you're just getting closer to where you're supposed to be, who you're supposed to be. I think that makes a big difference as well. So as you said, for the English, it's excellent, but it could really be extended as a whole life motto.
Yeah. And you've got to focus on the positives. I mean, you have no choice. You have to be optimistic. Whoops. Yeah, that's right. I lost my train of thought there for a second. You have to be up. That's it. Because if you're getting up really early to do your workout or whatever it is, You know, on one hand, you can, oh, it's dark, I want to be asleep. But you've got to look on the other side. Well, at least I'm up early. I've done it. You know, I'm actually up now. No one else is up. This is really cool. It's actually the best part of the day. Mm-hmm. And you've got to, you know, you tune into the good side of it and look for the good things and try to accentuate those. And it'll help you, I guess, get through the things which normally would be not so great. Like, yeah, going to the gym is like, yeah, right, another one ticked off.
Yeah, you know, sure. It's constantly getting closer to a goal. I know I'm coming close to the end of my time with you, so I'll just wrap up with one other question. And by the way, I'm really enjoying this conversation.
Yeah, this is great. Yeah,
I'd also Yeah, I'd also like to just take a wee moment to give thanks to my student Ivan. It was Ivan from Russia who encouraged me to make podcasts, and it was Ivan who introduced me to your podcast. And he says you should reach out to this guy. I reached out to you, and yeah, so just thank you to Ivan for making all this happen.
Ivan or Ivan or so I think it's Ivan probably, or Ivan. We'd say Ivan in England, in the UK and Scotland and Wales and Northern Ireland.
Yeah, sure. Ivan teaches me some Russian in our classes. He taught me, I also forget how to say it. Zadrova druk. Mm-hmm. How about yourself? Have you ever learned any bits of your students' languages? I know you're learning French right now.
Yeah, I'm doing French. I've learned some bits of students' languages. I mean, I've learned some Italian, but I'm not going to repeat it here because it's very rude.
Okay.
But it's the thing that it's the thing an Italian person would say when they do this with their hands. And it's saying, what the hell are you talking about? Or what the hell are you doing? But I shouldn't say it because it's rude, but I think Italians will know. I mean, I lived in Japan for a while, so obviously I learned some Japanese. But once a Japanese student of mine taught me the most scary thing that you can say in Japanese. And I was like, I said to him, tell me something that like a Yakuza guy would say when he was really angry, you know? So he taught me this thing. I can't remember what it is now, but I did actually say it to another Japanese student that I had. We all went to the pub after a course and I was with some Japanese students and I said, oh, I know something really scary in Japanese. And I said it to them. And they kind of didn't know what to say, either because I'd said it correctly or because I'd said it incorrectly. If I'd said it incorrectly, they'd be like, what? If I'd said it correctly, they'd be even more like, what? What are you saying? But yeah, little bits of students' languages. Yeah, it's one of the fun things about this job.
Sure. Sure, man. What kind of level of learners are you working with?
Well, at the moment at the British Council, where I teach, I'm teaching B2. Students.
So see, with your B2 students in France, what's a common problem that these students face, and how do you help them with it?
Ooh, well, that's a big question. That is a very big question. There are many things. I don't know where to begin. Mm-hmm. But I suppose
maybe just choose one. You can just focus on one.
Let's say the intermediate plateau, but that's very vague. But to be more specific, let's try and get more specific, and I'll say phrasal verbs, because
really French problem for students.
Absolutely, because in most languages, I don't think they really exist, and they are complicated for two reasons, like three reasons, really. One reason is because often they use delexicalized words, like, you know, to get on with someone, you know, for example. I mean, it almost means nothing, you know, when it's taken in isolation, you know, it means obtain and things like that, receive.
I think another problem with that is students try to translate, Google Translate phrasal verbs. And they're like, what does this mean? It doesn't make any sense, but it's not a way to learn phrasal verbs.
So they are idiomatic. They appear to mean nothing, and they're grammatically complicated because you can separate them sometimes, and sometimes you can't.
Yeah,
Two words and a preposition. People don't know. Prepositions are like those words that, like, not sure about these. Like, there's the big ones like noun, verbs, and adjectives. I know where they go in a sentence, but prepositions. That's obvious. So phrasal verbs are a problem for French people because they don't have them in French, and because French being a sort of Latin, Romance language, a lot of the equivalents or the French equivalents of our phrasal verbs would be very formal verbs in English. And this makes French people sound quite formal when they speak. They can be a bit formal sounding because they sort of lack those little verb phrases and things that sort of make our language a bit more, you know, friendly sounding or a bit more natural sounding.
Sure.
Yeah.
And how do you normally help students with that? Do you have a particular resource that's been useful?
just little bit by little bit, first of all, just sort of like, you know, introducing a few phrasal verbs from a course book or something like that and practicing and getting them to produce as much, as well as understanding. It's a complicated process. There's understanding what the phrasal verb means, how it works, and then the productive side, always trying to get them to give them opportunities to actually use the phrasal verbs in correct sentences a few times. And I feel like once they've used them a few times in a few meaningful ways, then they'll remember them. In terms of resources, I actually did a podcast series called A Phrasal Verb a Day. There's like 150 episodes of it.
Oh, wow.
Each episode is a couple of minutes long. And it deals with a different phrasal verb each time. The idea was the challenge I set myself. I don't know why I did this because it was a stupid idea. There's no way I could have done it. The idea was to do a phrasal verb lesson every single day for a year and post them up on a podcast channel. But I got about 3 months in and then life got in the way and I couldn't finish. But anyway, I've got about 150 episodes. And that's in my app, actually. I've got an app on both app stores, iOS and Android. So if you search for Luke's English Podcast app, you'll find it.
All of your links are in the bottom. So there's the app for iOS and Android. You've got your YouTube channel and you've got your website. Am I missing anything?
Well, I mean, just the podcast, you know, which is available wherever you get your podcasts. But I think that's enough.
Yeah, that'll cool. Do. All of your links are down below. I recommend everyone checks you out. But look, I know it's coming to a time you need to get your daughter from school, but thanks so much for coming on today.
Thanks for inviting me. It's been really good fun, and good luck with the videos and the rest of it, and have a lovely afternoon.
You too, man.
So that was my conversation with Ray Adam from English with Ray. Now, you will find links on the page for this episode on my website. If you'd like to find Ray, I mean, I'm not going to give you his address or anything, you know. I'm not. Although, if you are Liam Neeson out there, you will be able to find him anyway. But you'll be able to find, for example, links to his YouTube channel and any other sort of details that I have for him. Okay, so that was my conversation with Ray Adam, and it was very sort of interesting the way we ended up talking about all that sort of psychology of language learning and the confidence issues and ways you can manage that and stuff, and then sort of got specific into things like, you know, the issues that French learners have with English. Phrasal verbs are a big one, of course, and yes, you can find A Phrasal Verb a Day in the Luke's English Podcast app, but actually it's a podcast, so you can actually find it wherever you get your podcasts. So if you just search your podcast app for A Phrasal Verb a Day, you'll probably find it. It's also on Spotify now. So yeah, A Phrasal Verb a Day is still there. And yeah, something like 150 episodes. There are 140 episodes on Spotify and iTunes and stuff, but in the app there are, I think, 15 extra phrasal verb episodes there, so that's probably the best place to get them all. So there you go. All right. Well, very nice to you know, sort of do a swap cast like this. Initially, this was just supposed to be for Ray. He contacted me and sort of reached out to arrange an interview. And then at the end, he said to me, you know, feel free to post this. You can, you know, it would be great if you could actually post this on your podcast or on your YouTube channel. And so I'm happy to do that. I think it was a good conversation. I think, listeners, that you will agree there were sort of good things to take away from this. Things to consider and things to maybe to apply to yourself, attitude wise and sort of habit wise as well. So there you go. I did hint. Did you hear that noise? I don't know if you did. You probably did. If you didn't, I'll just carry on. What was I going to say? So earlier in the episode, in the audio episode, so the YouTube version is actually finished now. But here in the audio version, we're still going. In fact, the audio versions will often have more content than the video version. So often the video is just the interview part without the sort of little introduction. So I try and keep my introductions brief these days. Anyway, the video versions don't have the introduction. They don't often have the rambling part at the end as well. So here we are in the audio zone doing a bit of rambling. I did say at the beginning that I would possibly end with a song, and I thought, all right, I'll give it a go. So, okay, so those of you who don't like my singing and stuff, then thank you so much for listening. But this is pretty much the end, okay? I'm going to say bye-bye-bye, all right? So you get that. And then I'll do this little song. I'll talk about it a bit and try and do it. And then you'll hear the jingle, and that will be the end of the episode. Okay, so thank you so much for listening. And I will speak to you properly again in the next episode, which will be arriving soon. But for now, it's just time to say goodbye. Bye, 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 bye. Right. So I've said bye, bye, bye. So, okay, you know me. I always like to do songs by Neil Innes. It's just like, I don't know. I do try and do songs by other people too. Recently, I did, you know, that Coldplay song and stuff. But I just keep coming back to this particular songwriter, and I just enjoy his songs so much. I've talked about him before. But anyway, this is a song he wrote for the Ruttles album, which was released in the mid-90s. The Beatles, in the mid-90s, did the Anthology Project, and the Ruttles then came out with the Archaeology Project, where they kind of recorded some new songs and released some sort of outtakes and things. So the Ruttles are a parody group, you know, they parody the Beatles in a very clever, a very spot-on way. And so this is a song by Neil Innes in a sort of a John Lennon mode, I would say. It sort of feels like one of those later period Beatles songs of John's on the piano. I'm going to try and play it on the guitar. But it's called Questionnaire. And what I love about this song is that Neil Innes has managed to write a song about those people in the street who come up to you with clipboards, and they will often have T-shirts with logos on them. They come up to you because they want to ask you questions because they're doing a questionnaire. It's like some sort of consumer survey or whatever. They're trying to get information. And so they come up to you. You know, usually you try and avoid them in the street. You try and, you know, walk around them, but sometimes they get you and you end up having to answer their questions and do their questionnaire. So this is actually a song in that sort of John Lennon style, about being accosted by a clipboard questionnaire person in the street. Okay. And it's a mix of sort of funny and quite deep. It's interesting. It's a great song. So you can imagine sort of a John Lennon sort of singing this, you know. Okay. Hey, Mr. Man in the street, excuse me. Do you have a few moments to spare? Oh, yeah. Don't worry, I'm not trying to sell you anything you wouldn't want. I'm just a questionnaire. Tell me what you think about this low-fat diet shampoo. Do you think it's crunchy, half crunchy, or not crunchy at all? Put a tick in the appropriate box. There's nothing to it. Yes, no, don't know. I don't care. I'm only a questionnaire. Only a questionnaire. Please, Mr. Man in the street, excuse me. I'm only doing my job and I need to know. Oh, everything about you, take it easy, all you gotta do is answer yes or no. Tell me what you think about the devil and the deep blue sea. Do you think there's one true God, false God, or no God at all?
put a tick in the appropriate box. There's nothing to it. Yes, no, don't know, I don't care. I'm only a questionnaire. Yes, no, don't know, I don't care. I'm only a questionnaire. Only a questionnaire. Tell me what you think about how easy it can be to buy a gun. Do you think it's crazy, half crazy, or not crazy at all? Put a tick in the appropriate box.
Thanks for listening to Luke's English podcast. For more information, visit teacherluke.co.uk.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
If you enjoyed this episode of Luke's English Podcast, consider signing up for Luke's English Podcast Premium. You'll get regular premium episodes with stories, vocabulary, grammar, and pronunciation teaching from me, and the usual moments of humour and fun. Plus, with your subscription, you will be directly supporting my work and making this whole podcast project possible. For more information about Luke's English Podcast Premium, go to teacherluke.co.uk/premium info.